This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening. Welcome to the CAPS Forum on Ethics and Public Policy. My name is Greg Jarrett. I represent the Walter H. CAPS Center for the Study of Ethics, Religion, and Public Life. This event is co-sponsored by the Environmental Studies Program and the Bren School of Environmental Science and Management. And we give a special thanks to the Community Environmental Council for helping making this happen. In anticipation of the Paris Climate Summit this winter, we thought it would be important to bring in someone who could speak across disciplines about this very crucial topic, as well as the general community and interested students. We've brought in classes from the earth sciences, classes from global studies, economics, environmental studies, literature and the environment, and my own class on environmental ethics. Mark Shapiro is a veteran environmental journalist who covers the intersection between the environment, economics, and international politics. He is a former editorial director and senior correspondent at the Center for Investigative Reporting. He is widely published in magazines such as Harper's, The Atlantic, Yale 360, The Nation, Mother Jones, and others. He has also worked as a reporter and correspondent for PBS's Frontline World and for NPR's Marketplace. He currently teaches at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism and at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. His books include, the title's a little long here, so his books include Exposed, The Toxic Chemistry of Everyday Products and What's at Stake for American Power, 2, Circle of Poison, Pesticides and People in a Hungry World, and his latest book, which should be available for purchase in the foyer, his latest book, Carbon Shock, The Tale of Risk and Calculus on the Front Lines of the Disrupted Global Economy. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mark Shapiro.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure for me to be here. I grew up in L.A. I live in Oakland. Right between them is Santa Barbara. And I've always heard for years about this kind of little hotbed of environmental thinking down here. So I'm really pleased to be here with you tonight, talking about this matter of some significance. Climate change, probably the fundamental challenge of our time. So I like to write about the intersection between all the kind of multiple disciplines. One of the reasons I think climate change is so amazing, number one, is so urgent for all of us, which should be self-evident, and also is so important to actually report on and understand, is because it hits all the different aspects of our lives, basically. It hits the natural world that we live in. It hits the economic world that we live in, the political world, the legal world. It's why this book, Carbon Shock, has this incredibly long subtitle that I often even have to look at the book to remember. It's a tale of risk and calculus on the front lines of the disrupted global economy. Hopefully that's absolutely clear. In it, I do go to different parts of the world where the costs of climate change and fossil fuels are being experienced today. But first, I want to talk about the scientific discovery that, not necessarily of climate change itself, which, as you know, has been around for at least 30 years, at least the revelations around that, but the about 7 years ago, just imagine, go back 7 years, all the way back to 2008. Sure, most of you were cognizant then. About 7 years ago, a group of geomorphologists, everybody know who geomorphologists are? They study water and the way that water comes down from the atmosphere and shapes the earth that we live on, and also enables us, of course, to drink, and it feeds the oceans, and it feeds the mountains, and it creates snowpacks, and all these various things that also shapes the earth, which is why it's called morphology. A team of geomorphologists, let's call them water scientists, began noticing incredible anomalies in their studies of water flow and precipitation coming down from the atmosphere. And what they noticed were past patterns of water behavior, the way that water fell from the atmosphere down into the earth, were no longer reliable indicators of future patterns. Do I have to tell you this? Here we are in Santa Barbara, where the big signs on 101 say severe drought. But what's interesting is the variability that has been normal within the water flow from the atmosphere to the earth was no longer reliable. That variability was getting blown open on both sides. And they realized that the past was no longer a reliable predictor of the future. And these people are basically involved in trying to determine where dams should go, how you rebuild riverine systems to enable water to flow steadily and to create a fresh water supply, both for ecological reasons and for ourselves, for agriculture, and many different reasons. But if you don't know where and when the water is going to fall, you have a problem. So they went and they wrote a paper. And I have, just so you know, I'm not making this stuff up, I have their paper that's right here. And what's interesting about it is this. The title that they gave to this paper is this incredible title, and they called it Stationarity is Dead. Has anybody heard the word stationarity before? Hey, we got a couple people down there. Thank you. So it's not an ancient Buddhist philosophy, although it could be, actually, applied to basic Buddhism. But this notion of stationarity is the idea that scientists, basically, when they study the Earth, they want to have a stable, they want to have a moment of baseline of stationariness. And then they have a moment of stationariness, they can inject different variables to actually understand what's going to happen in the future when you introduce different variables. That is a moment of stationariness. And what they announce in this extraordinary paper in Science magazine, it's like a three-page paper, it's actually pretty easy to read, was stationarity is dead. There's no more stationary moment. And of course, being scientists, they actually added a subhead to that, which is wither water management, which I've always loved. It's some old English version of, like, what do we water managers do? This injected a huge amount. This was a very interesting and important paper to come out at that time. Never before had people who actually study water determined that you could not take the past behavior of the atmospheric system and use it to predict what would happen in the future. There were a huge amount of response to that paper. And so 7 years later, the scientists, the same group of scientists, who, by the way, include a scientist from our own U.S. Geological Survey, who is a lead scientist on this case, as well as scientists from other top institutions around the world, wrote a response to all the criticisms and responses that they'd had to this original paper. This paper, by the way, came out just in September, very recently, in the American Geophysical Union. And this is called On Critiques of Stationarity is Dead, Wither Water Management. And what's interesting about this paper is the scientists went back, they studied their own assessments. As you know, the scientific process is all about questioning not only yourself, other people, but also yourself, analyzing your own findings. And they, in fact, found that 7 years later, the evidence for their initial assertion was even stronger. And they reiterated this finding. They actually stated that we were entering into an enormous period of unknowns when it came into the natural conditions here on the planet. And they started with water, but I think we can all understand that this actually affects other things. Water is, of course, a central factor here on Earth. What do they go look for in outer space to find signs of life? They look for water. I spoke with the lead scientist on this study, who, as I said, is at the U.S. Geological Survey. And I was asking about the response of this to this paper. And he's been called, by the way, to from water districts. He's on the East Coast, so East Coast water districts all up and down the eastern coast, to consult with them because the water engineers are beginning to get very uneasy because they can no longer look to the past to predict what's going to happen in the future. So he comes in and tells them what they're not able to know and tries to surmise what they might be able to do with this kind of little amount of information in terms of planning for this enormous variability in the future. And what was interesting, I'll just quote you one thing that he told me, the scientist from the U.S. Geological Survey, and I actually just talked to him a couple weeks ago. This is all very current. And he told me, quote, people, planners, water designers need to consider the fact that the future is different from the past. For scientists, that is a revolutionary idea. No kidding. Including for the rest of us, I think. So, the reason I kind of lay out this study, and I actually have my students in journalism, I teach journalism one semester a year at a Berkeley International Environmental Reporting, and I always have them read these studies because I want them to know this world that we're entering into, this enormous world of volatility and dynamism that is happening now. And so what's happening is actually the very same shifts. The volatility that's occurring in the natural world is also occurring in our political and economic world. And that's why I wrote this book, Carbon Shock, was to actually capture this dynamic as we speak, this enormous amount of volatility in the kind of political and economic world that we all live in, that is reflects the enormous volatility in the natural world. We have climate change and the pressure it's putting on our political and economic system is altering the fundamental principles of geopolitics, of economics, of how we think about finance, changes in the law, changes in technology, a huge amount of dynamism and volatility in this world. And so what we essentially have are two basic forces occurring at the same time. We have unprecedented disequilibrium in the form of new ways of understanding finance, politics, economics, enormous volatility and uncertainty in those areas. And what we also have, and this is beginning to accelerate now in our time right now, and actually I think you can notice in the last year or two a real change in the popular culture and in the political culture, you have the fact that just like an organism, just the way that a natural organism, a biological organism, and the Earth is an organism, if you think about it as an organism with all the multiple natural forces that work that keep it and keep us and all the other animals and beings and microscopic amoeba here alive on Earth is an organism. And in this great organism, we are also slowly finding a new equilibrium that is actually starting to take shape in this dynamic and volatile world as people respond to this enormous volatility that is occurring in the natural world. And that's kind of what I want to talk about a little bit here tonight, is these two simultaneous forces that I think mark this particular era that we are in. So number one, let's start with the notion of the financial world that we are in. Huge amount of disequilibrium and change within the financial world. You have, what's interesting is, I don't know if some of you know this organization called Carbon Tracker, which has been doing this very important work, assessing the risk that fossil fuel companies face over the coming decades. Carbon Tracker was the first organization, a bunch of economists and consultants based in London, now they've expanded to the United States, that analyze in depth the financial status of the fossil fuel companies. And they were the ones who identified this notion that over the next decade or two, we're going to have a whole array of stranded assets, of assets that are now controlled by the oil and coal companies, which will no longer be able to be accessed given the enormous amount of changes that are happening politically and economically when it comes to fossil fuels. Now, why do I mention this? Number one, Carbon Tracker is a very sophisticated organization. They are advocating changes within the geopolitical structure when it comes to climate change. What's happened in the last year? Well, it turns out that some of the leading financial institutions in the world are also beginning to see the same things that were identified by Carbon Tracker, and you could even say by the environmentalists who you know who are saying, oh my God, the world is kind of, you know, things are shifting, and we've got to change our policies away, change our preferences away from fossil fuels. Well, guess who else is starting to say that? HSBC, huge bank, huge global bank, HSBC, is starting to talk about the enormous risks that are being confronted by the fossil fuel companies as a result of technological innovation, as a result of individual government initiatives to reduce our use of fossil fuels. Oil companies have faced a serious set of challenges to their dominion and the presumption of them as these kind of huge entities that will continue no matter what into the future as the enormously profitable enterprises they've been in the past. What was interesting is that Standard & Poor's, another hardly environmental organization, recently downgraded the credit rating of Shell Oil Company. And one of the reasons they did that, if they've identified this very fundamental idea, and this is important when it comes to oil, and we'll get into some other elements of disequilibrium, but it's the point is to challenge basically what the way we presume that the Earth is, world is organized economically now is going through some very big changes. What Standard & Poor's saw and what other places are seeing is that oil companies are now in the process of selling off all those cheap reserves they've been selling off, right? They've been selling off. They've got all these incredible holdings around the world, which I'm sure, hey, you got some of them right off the coast here in Santa Barbara. and those were developed very inexpensively relative to what is happening now. You've got the cheap reserves of oil coming onto the market, and if you're an oil company, what do you have to replace those with? You have to keep replacing. You have an unreplaceable product, right? It's not renewable. That's why they're not called renewable energy. You have to find new sources everywhere. And those new sources are getting more and more and more expensive to find. So, for example, what you have, just to give you a little taste, is the big international consulting firm, which has offices all around the world, including in San Francisco and other places, called Kepler Chevreux. And if you're interested, I can obviously give you references to all these kind of names here that I'm throwing out. I'm just trying to get some ideas out here, has actually concluded by looking at the oil company status that the industry's expenditures on developing new oil sources have increased 120% since 2000. That's a lot of money. We're talking about tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars put into developing new oil sources, 120% since 2000, while supplies of crude have increased just 11%. So the cost of obtaining new sources of oil is only increasing every step of the way. And I think that's an important factor that's influencing the instability in the oil companies. At the same time, you have great instability when it comes to food security. The FAO and others are talking about, the Food and Agriculture Organization and others are talking about the incredible stress that is now on the world food supply. And that's largely because of the temperature changes and the lack of water. There's an extraordinary map that actually shows you where the water stresses are all over the world. And it's the World Resources Institute, which is a leading kind of environmental think tank. They've actually done a map of all the places where food is grown and where the water is under enormous stress. And guess where those places are? The very same hot red that's in that map includes northern Africa, probably not surprisingly, parts of southwest China, parts of Southeast Asia, Central America, and Mexico, and the Midwest of the United States and the Central Valley of California. What does that mean? Number one, let's point out what it means if you're an American. So, for example, the same amount of water stress is being experienced in the Midwest as it is in Northern Africa. What's the basic difference between water stress here in Santa Barbara County, Alameda County also, where I live, or all over California or the Midwest? What's the basic difference, aside from the fact that we're in America? Well, the basic difference is that we in America have something called crop insurance. Crop insurance was a system, very quick explanation of crop insurance, very important to this story. Crop insurance was a system developed in the 1930s. After what happened in the 1930s? Dust Bowl. Did I hear Dust Bowl? Yes. So, kind of right on the heels of the Depression, we had this massive Dust Bowl in Oklahoma, and huge devastating dust storms, dry heat, hundreds of thousands of farmers in Oklahoma and other parts of the Southwest forced off their land. Were they able to stay on their land? No. They couldn't stay on their land any longer. They moved. Huge waves of migration coming to where? California. You've all read Grapes of Wrath, I assume. Yes. Grapes of Wrath, one of the great pieces of literature written about exactly this phenomenon. So after the Dust Bowl, President Roosevelt, with a farmer vice president, Henry Wallace, who happened to be a farmer, devised a system called crop insurance, which is extremely complicated. And I'm not going to go into a whole thing about crop insurance because that's like five lectures worth. But the main point about the crop insurance system was designed to guarantee that farmers would never be forced off the land, right, because of a bad weather, because of a bad year. And to a great extent, it's largely succeeded. There are other things happening in agriculture that push farmers off the land, but it's not generally the weather, because you can basically get insurance to stay on the land. In fact, what has been, when we talk about the hidden costs of climate change, which I write about in Carbon Shock, the ways that the costs of fossil fuels have not been integrated into our economy, what has been the fastest growing payouts from the U.S. crop insurance system? Factors due to climate change. And it's not just me saying that. For the first time in history, about 2 years ago in 2013, the USDA, United States Department of Agriculture, itself said that climate change was responsible for an enormous growth in the payouts for crop insurance. It went from about $7 billion to about $17 billion within the last 10 years. That, by the way, is money that comes from all of you and me. I pay taxes too. So, so if you want to know how your money is going to pay for fossil fuels, that's one way to think about it. Now, if you happen to be in Somalia, or you happen to be in somewhere in North Africa, or you happen to be in Mexico, or you happen to be in Guatemala or Honduras, where the similar kind of stresses on the water system are happening, do they have crop insurance? No. What happens? They leave. They leave the land. And so what you have is huge amounts of refugees flooding onto the borders of the United States and the European Union. Now, this is not the only reason. There are many other reasons, obviously, for the flow of refugees that are pressing on the borders of the United States and the European Union. You've read about the Mediterranean in Europe. Obviously, we know about the United States here. It's one of the biggest issues in the political campaign. But one of the major results of this water stress is the displacement of people from their homes, which is, back to the question of disequilibrium, one of the major reasons why the U.S. Department of Defense now characterizes climate change as a fundamental threat to national security of the United States. This is a very big development in the last couple of years. The United States Department of Defense says that climate change presents a threat to the United States, a national security threat, because of the enormous displacement that it is causing and is expected to cause over time. The other kind of factors, so it's factors like this that are leading to this enormous kind of disequilibrium, this enormous amount of volatility and unease that is actually rippling through the international order. And the I just want to point out, bringing us back to this notion of climate risk, the Bank of England, which is, of course, the Federal Reserve. Actually, I discovered this, so I don't expect you all to know this. I didn't know it when I first read about it. But the Bank of England is essentially the Federal Reserve Board of the United Kingdom of Great Britain. And the Bank of England has now required, fearing that there would be enormous economic stability as a result of the impacts of climate change, has ordered a whole sequence of climate stress tests on financial institutions throughout the United Kingdom to figure out what kind of risks that they face from climate change over the coming decades. This is a very big development. So they have to basically talk about what kind of risk does climate change present to their supply chains? What does it suggest to their infrastructure? What is the impact of technological innovation that may make their product particularly less relevant? And of course, what is the impact potentially of regulation on fossil fuels over time? And these reports, by the way, are going to be coming out over the coming year from the Bank of England, and they're worth keeping an eye out on. So this is the picture of disequilibrium, unease, great unrest, and dissonance in the international order. Now let's talk about equilibrium, the seeking for equilibrium. And I think some actual fundamental factors are actually taking shape and are unfolding right now, both in this country and around the world, that is actually seeking to basically find a way through this time of incredible uncertainty, do the economic calculations that are critical to understanding what the impacts of climate change are on our economic and political system. And one of the fundamental facts that is beginning to actually surface, and which I write about in Carbon Shock and demonstrate in story after story after story about how this is happening, is the basic idea, and this is, I wrote the book, this book came out the end of last year, and one of the real reasons I wanted to write this was to dispense with the illusion that we've been operating under. And that illusion has been this kind of false dichotomy. And the false dichotomy is essentially that we have a choice. And the choice is between the status quo, which is the way it is, the way we use energy in the status quo, and this future period of renewable energy that's going to cost hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, and how are we going to come up with the money to engineer and facilitate this move towards more renewable energy. This is this completely false dichotomy. And it's one of the primary motives that pushed me to write this book, because I got because I understand the economic factors at work. And if you go to look for the costs of climate change that are actually basically hidden by the current economic system, they're not that difficult to find. And I went up and down, for example, the Central Valley of California here to find out how farmers were experiencing climate change, and discovered the difficult economic decisions they were making about taking certain crops out of commission, about having to possibly remove entire orchards full of cherries and other very sensitive crops and move north into Washington or Oregon because they can no longer grow them because it's getting too hot. The weather doesn't get cold enough in many parts of the San Joaquin Valley and other places like that. Crops, you probably know this being here in Santa Barbara, tree crops particularly have to get cold during the winter in order to come back with all the beautiful blossoms and cherries in particular, peaches, apricots, and those crops are being devastated in different parts of the Central Valley. What's also interesting is the understanding, at the same time, the seeking for equilibrium. What's actually happened at the same time that this disequilibrium is happening is the understanding that to actually grow food in a way that's more resilient to these huge changes, resilient to the kind of changes in water patterns, dealing with the extreme weather conditions that come with climate change, are more sustainable, organic, agriculture. And I'm not an expert in organic farming, and I'm not here to explain the principles of organic farming here, but I will tell you the most interesting thing has been to see the USDA itself arguing for the very first time, given all the money they've had to spend to for crop insurance to actually keep farmers on the land with all these huge changes, is beginning in their new guidelines to sound like a bunch of hippies up in Sonoma. Because and they talk in the guidelines from the USDA about the importance of having soil very very rich in organic matter, which absorbs water much more effectively, that's not depleted of its nutrients by the chemicals that are applied to big industrial mass-scale agriculture, and the importance of diverse cropping so that some crops will do better than others and some crops will actually return minerals to the soil that otherwise get depleted. And it's an extraordinary document, and it's the first time it's ever happened, and it's because those people are looking at the science, and there's a lot of science that's being done on this. There's got to be more as time goes on, where studies are being done that show that the farms that survive extreme conditions are those with deeper organic material. And so one of the shifts that you're going to see over time, I think, and another way to kind of seeking this equilibrium, in search of equilibrium, is a greater promotion of this kind of agriculture, number one, because on the one hand, the argument has been that it's better for us and it's less toxic substances in the crops, in the residues. And one of my books is about pesticide residues, so I'm pretty familiar with that topic. But fundamentally, there's actually an enormous economic move afoot to realize that, my God, we are actually, we could actually save money in our crop insurance system if we encourage these kind of crop farms that will cost us less to pay farmers to stay on the land because they'll survive more and they'll produce more crops in the extreme conditions being brought by climate change. So this is another example of this search for equilibrium. And what you also have is fundamental changes in legal principles that have actually been emerging, and I think the law is actually an interesting area to watch in the way that the legal system is beginning to grapple with the complexities of climate change. And I'll give you an example right here in the state of California. Right here in the state of California, you have the state, which I believe was under Schwarzenegger, passed a low-carbon fuel standard, and then it was affirmed and kind of, and I maybe actually have been passed under Jerry Brown, the low-carbon fuel standard, which requires a dramatic reduction in the amount of carbon intensity in the fuels, right, which means less oil and more biofuels to be integrated into fuels. Well, the state of California, this is just a very, I think, an interesting, revealing story. The state of California was challenged on this measure by a group of Midwestern corn farmers and other farmers who protested to the state of protested the court that the measure constituted discrimination against out-of-state farmers because, as part of the law, the low-carbon fuel standard, the state was empowered to assess the life cycle of those biofuels, right? And for those of you studying environmental studies, you're familiar with life cycle, basically from the beginning where the resource is extracted to the processing to the distribution of that resource is and the dispensing of that resource is the life cycle, the entire life cycle of a resource. And California was empowered to assess the life cycle of different varieties of biofuels. And the Midwestern farmers hooked up with the Western Petroleum Association, the oil companies, to sue the state and try to block that measure. And on the grounds of interstate commerce, that you can't, you know, one state can't stop commerce from another state. That's why we're United States of America and et cetera. We're one big economic entity. The interesting thing is they won, actually, at the first initial court trial. They actually won. California was forced to stop implementation of the low-carbon fuel standard, which was a surprise to people, certainly in Sacramento. They appealed, the state of California appealed. the decision by the appeals court of the state of the Ninth Circuit, which is the federal appeals court, right before the Supreme Court, was a amazing document. And for those of you studying law, I really recommend reading this document, The Intersection Between Law and Environmental Science, because for the first time, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals affirmed the right of the state of California to assess a life cycle analysis of the biofuels coming into the state from other parts of the United States of America. For the first time, a state was given the power to discriminate, essentially, against other out-of-state fuels based on their carbon footprint, based on their carbon footprint. And a key point, of course, is that the biofuels coming out of the Midwest, because of various complicated matters, including the crops that are grown there and the way it's processed and the way it's transported, have a much heavier carbon footprint than the ones in California. So when you want to think about life cycle analysis, for the first time, that is now a precedent in the American legal system that actually a state has the right to do this. And I predict these kind of cases are going to continue up the chain as we continue to, as climate change begins to kind of enter into the legal system in a whole new way. And need I mention that, need I mention the particular quandary that Exxon Mobil now finds itself in? And if you're not familiar with this particular story of the last week, I certainly suggest you check it out, which is essentially the stories that have come out about how Exxon Mobil sent its scientists to go study the possibility of climate change and the effect on the glaciers and up in the Arctic back in the 1970s, and actually discovered that actually there was a very good chance that, in fact, this thing called climate change, which was very early back then, could in fact be happening and could very well be linked to fossil fuels, which of course they produce. And what did ExxonMobil do? It swallowed the report, did everything in its power to ensure it would not be released into the public, and then began funding the anti-climate science campaigns that we all came to know and love over the following decades. And what's interesting about that development is, one, you have the biggest oil company in America saying that climate change is very much, very well happening, and it likely is caused by our product, stepping on that information, not letting it get out to the public, financing efforts to discredit those findings by other scientists, testifying to this in the United States Congress and telling us, the American public, that this was the case, that climate science was not convincing. And they now face, are they potentially legally liable for not telling the truth to the American public? No. But they may very well be liable for not telling the truth to their own shareholders, which is definitely not what you do if you're a major publicly owned company. You are supposed to tell your investors all the potential risks that you have ahead. Exxon was sitting on this huge body of evidence about the risks it faced and didn't tell its shareholders. And now, just to point out, the New York State Attorney General has initiated an investigation into this exact phenomenon, and it's now become an issue in the presidential campaign. As you know, Hillary Clinton just announced that she supports this idea of an investigation into Exxon Mobil, the biggest oil company in America. So meanwhile, you have the growth of what is often called the green economy, which is actually beginning to, the prices are coming down rather dramatically when it comes to solar and other kinds of energy sources. The green economy is one of the fastest growing sort of sectors of the economy, according to Bloomberg. Goldman Sachs says the same thing. If you want to make money, put it in the green economy. There's not a bunch of environmentalists running around saying this. It's actually some of the top environmental financial institutions that are pushing this idea. Several hundred billion dollars last year invested in the green economy. So in this way, kind of the world is kind of seeking kind of a way through this very difficult time when there is enormous uncertainty in every place we look. Finally, the knowledge of the enormous costs, the largely hidden costs that are caused by fossil fuels. And I go in my book in Carbonshock, I go to different parts of the world to try to understand how this works. I go to the Central Valley to figure out how it works with farmers. I go to the Amazon jungle to figure out what impact this is happening in the Amazon. And it's very important part of the world with tropical rainforests play a very important role. And I go to different cities in this country and around the world to actually begin to understand how the urban areas are both experiencing the impacts of climate change and trying to deal with those incredible costs. And I go to a place where I'm going to tell you the story of a place that I went to actually begin to understand the notion of what it means to have this kind of idea of a price for carbon. Finally, it brings us to the question, do we have a price for carbon? What should it be? How do we understand what it is? And and I'm going to tell you this little story, and I will get to some specifics about this price for carbon. I want to understand what the price for carbon is because it's kind of a very abstract idea. I brought a little prop with me, and this prop is a rock. It's right here. And this rock, if you can see it, is black. It's a stone. It's about the size, you can see how big it is. And it is covered with oil. And if you want to understand how to comprehend what the costs of climate change have been and how we've been dealing with the cost of fossil fuels until now, the reason I have this rock, and here I picked this rock up off a beach in western Spain. If anybody's ever been to Spain, in the province of Galicia, which is the furthermost western province of Spain. And off the coast of Spain, this is based on the North Atlantic, very rough, very cold, on a November night in 2002, an oil tanker came around the bend from the North Sea. You know, it goes from the North Sea and you turn left down the coast of Spain, and right along the coast of Spain, this enormous winter storm blew up waves that were like 30 feet high, violent waves. And into these waves churns an oil tanker called the Prestige. And the oil tanker was bounced around like a little toy boat in the middle of that ocean. And after several hours of being bounced around, it sank. And it broke in two, dropped to the bottom of the sea. And out from the hold of that tanker came 30,000 tons of oil onto the burbling up to the surface, washing with the currents onto the shoreline of Spain. And over basically about 700 miles from Spain, all around the bend, the beaches were covered with this splattered oil. And I went to that beach because I wanted to understand why that ship had sunk and what the impacts were. And I walked around on those boulders on this windswept nowhere of a little beach. And it's not like a beach, you know, with bikinis. It's not like a beach here in Santa Barbara. It's a cold, windswept, desolate, moist, misty, cold place that you would never ordinarily go to unless you were going to examine what had happened as a result of this incredible oil spill. And all along in every direction, north towards Ireland, nothing but oil-splattered rock. And looking down south towards Africa, nothing but oil-splattered rock. And I ended up doing a story at that time for Frontline World, PBS Frontline World. And I never wanted to forget. I stood there on those rocks, and I could smell the smell of a gasoline station in the middle of absolute nowhere. And I never wanted to forget what that whole experience was like. And so I took this rock and I put it in my pocket and I brought it back. And it's been sitting on my desk now for about 10 years. And it's there as a little reminder of what an oil spill means. Now, what does that tell us about climate change? Well, it's taken years to clean up those beaches. It's cost like at least 6 billion euros to, which is about $8 billion, to try to at least clean to some minimal level those beaches of all that oil. You know this in Santa Barbara. I don't have to tell you about oil spills. But this was far bigger than this recent spill you had. It was the actually biggest oil spill in history until British Petroleum came along, and then they kind of beat the prestige. alas, in the big sweepstakes of oil spills, far bigger than the Exxon Valdez oil spill. What was amazing is that $8 to $9 billion it cost to clean up this area. The fishing was devastated. No more fish could come from the western coast of Spain, which is known for its fish. Tourism was devastated. Entire villages lost their economic basis for several years. And who has ended up paying for those damages? Anybody responsible for the ship? The Spanish government tried to actually identify who was responsible for the ship, and it turns out the ship was in terrible shape, and it was destined, and basically, former captains talked about basically how it was kind of an accident waiting to happen. It was an ancient, creaky old ship that they sent off into this journey. The people who bore the cost of that were the people of Spain and the people of Europe, who actually had to finance the cleaning of that, because every time the government tried to find the owner. By the way, the ship was carrying the flag of the Bahamas, which doesn't exactly have a strong regulatory system, and the ship itself was registered where? Where was it registered? Can you possibly guess? Almost Panama. Thank you, Liberia. Yes, the thriving, sophisticated metropolis of Liberia, which is where 2/3 of the oil tankers today are registered. The reason, of course, being that that's where the legal incorporation is, so you can't find anybody. You can't, and they basically registered as a one-ship company. So, of course, its assets were at the bottom of the sea. The point of that whole story is that nobody was ever held accountable for those costs, which is very much the similar problem we have had with climate change. And that is why people are talking about a price for carbon, to actually begin to account for these socialized costs, the costs that the people, that the public pays as a result of the use of fossil fuels. And in a sense, if you want to think about climate change, think of it as we're releasing an oil spill a day into the atmosphere. At least an oil spill a day, probably a lot more. And in terms of we, the society, are paying those costs, which are not reflected in the cost of fossil fuels. So that brings us to the ultimate question, which is how do you deal with the price for carbon? And very quickly, I just want to go through a couple of mechanisms that have been established. When you hear about a price for carbon in the state of California, we have a kind of a cap and trade system. In Europe, of course, they have a cap and trade system. This is the mechanism that has been chosen in these places to try to establish, to try to compensate, to try to generate the money to actually put a cost for fossil fuels that actually reflect its actual costs or larger costs. So it's not borne by society, so it's actually reflected in the actual costs. And the interesting thing to think about that is there's also discussions about a tax for carbon. I wouldn't say they're very active discussions, at least politically speaking, now, but actually serious economists are talking about the only way to deal with to provide a reliable price for carbon is through the tax system, which is far more direct than the cap and trade system, which, you know, I try to explain that in the book here. The cap and trade had some problems, but it's an effort to establish a price for this carbon. And the final thing I'll say then about this, about a notion of a price for carbon, is I went to I was invited to the legislature, the state legislature of Vermont. This is a very unusual thing for me, I can assure you. invited me to testify to this earlier this year, because Vermont is seriously thinking of imposing a carbon tax within the state, which would actually be pretty amazing. Vermont's a tiny little state, of course, but they are seriously considering the idea of a carbon tax to actually encourage the development of renewable energy within the state. and to basically begin reducing their own emissions. And they invited me to testify because of having written this book. Some of the legislators had actually read it, astoundingly. And I assure you, I'm not accustomed to like sitting at the table in a legislature and talking about my work. I'm usually outside the door trying to sort of grab somebody and confront them about something. But there I was, astounding even myself, in the depths of winter in Vermont, going to these hearings, one in the House, State House, and the other in the State Senate of Vermont in Montpelier, which is beautiful in winter. What was interesting was their contemplation of what this tax would mean for the little old state of Vermont. And in the process of getting ready to testify, I read some of the reports that came out about what it would actually mean in Vermont by a very respected environmental consulting firm that did this report for the state legislature. I wanted to read what they were doing. The most interesting thing I learned was this. That basically, if you did a tax for carbon, people would lose their jobs, and people would win jobs. There would be a trade-off, and actually was very clear in this study. And I thought it was refreshing because it was the first kind of honest and accurate assessment, I think, of the kind of decisions that we face. And the the tax was not huge, by the way. It was kind of like $10 went up to $50. Over about 25 years, it was fairly minimal. What was most interesting was the list, and they literally had a list, they had a graph of who would lose their jobs, basically, as a result of this. And if you're a state politician, you've got to be watching this stuff. And the people who would lose their jobs, of course, would be the kind of truckers, would be the people who ran gas stations, the people who ran retail outlets affiliated with gas stations, people who ran restaurants affiliated with truck stops, and a whole array of people affiliated with the kind of fossil fuel moving transport system would lose jobs. And then there was another column of people that would gain jobs that would be gained within the state of Vermont. And it was interesting to see that, of course, because, of course, you had the renewable energy industry, the wind guys and the solar companies. You'd had the high-tech companies because they felt like high-tech people would be attracted to this kind of place. And you had construction people because they'd get hired to do more solar and more wind and et cetera, et cetera. And there was this very interesting balance, and it was roughly the same on either side. I think they were actually somewhat more jobs created than were lost, but it basically is roughly the same. And so I thought, number one, that is a very important thing to remember, because what we're talking about is a fundamental shift in the way that energy is going to be created in this country. And basically what the Vermont people were doing, were trying to, number one, address that head on, number two, retain as much money as they could within the state economy of Vermont, because by doing a tax, you keep the money within the state of Vermont rather than sending it to these distant oil companies, whether in Houston or Saudi Arabia or wherever they might be. And you channel it back into the local economy through a system of dividends back to the public. So you keep it within the Vermont system. But the most important thing was to realize that when we talk about the green economy, we have this boom, and I think there's no question about all the multiple jobs that are going to be created with the green economy. And there are also going to be people who are going to lose their jobs in this kind of shift. And so practically speaking, we have to kind of address that as you think about the climate thing in a broader picture, to think how you're going to create a system that will actually help the people who are going to lose their jobs and encourage the people in this kind of new renewable energy economy that I think we have to head towards. Because if we don't, here's what's going to happen is basically the draw on your resources, on our public resources, is going to get more and more and more. So basically, as that happens, those of us who pay taxes, those of us who are part of the functioning society that we're in, are going to find more and more of our resources diverted into responses to climate change, into the building of infrastructure and the responses to the extreme storms, the extreme conditions, the extreme droughts that we're going to face. And the only way to hold that off is to begin discouraging the use of fossil fuels through this kind of more accurate mechanism of accounting for those costs. So this is the background to the negotiations that are happening in Paris. As you know, there's also a lot of changes geopolitically. The Chinese are actually much more active than they've ever been before. The United States of America is going to go over with, actually for the first time, some real influence because we've been taking some active measures through the Obama administration. State of California is going to be very influential as well. But into this world we will be going, into this world of the end of stationarity. Thank you.
That's great.
Thank you very much. We have two microphones for questions right here up in the front. I want to let at least the first few questions come from the undergraduates to give them an opportunity to speak up. Please have the courage to come to the front and either this one, I think there's one on both sides, and ask a question of the speaker. Let's start over here.
Hi.
Hi.
So in this government, we kind of really hate taxes. So do you think that a carbon tax could possibly be implemented by the federal government? Or would sort of a cap and trade system, maybe without the offsets, be a more effective solution if it's state run?
Well, I think probably realistically that if, depending on what happens politically, of course, in the next election cycle, but it's more realistically speaking, if we're going to be establishing this notion of a price for carbon, it's probably going to come through a cap and trade system. I actually have written about the cap and trade. I think there have been kind of flaws in the way it's organized without going into all the details about it, but I think it is a more politically palatable form than a carbon tax that everybody kind of runs away from. However, the one thing I want to say about the carbon tax idea is that it is beginning to grow, even from the kind of conservative economists who are actual advocates of the free market, because I think there's an understanding, even among conservative economists, and there's a former Republican South Carolina representative who's been pushing this idea, very conservative out of South Carolina, because they understand that the current way the system is organized is a complete distortion of the free market. Basically, you have fossil fuel companies that make the profits. You have society that pays the costs, which if you're a free market, if you really believe in the free market, is a complete distortion of the free market order. So the notion of a carbon tax is not a bunch of crazy environmentalists. In fact, some big companies, both American companies and European companies, are calling for a global tax because that will actually create more predictability and more reliability of being able to plan over the next 10, 20, 30 years. But the debate is still in play, but I think the notion of a tax is still very much being discussed. But politically, you're probably right. If anything was to happen, it would probably be cap and trade.
Great. Well, ladies and gentlemen, let's give a warm thanks to Mark Shapiro.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.